Hello, and thank you for tuning in to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Each week, Inside Education brings you the best from the world of education with an Irish perspective. My name is Sean Delaney, and you can listen to or download hundreds of podcasts of previous editions of Inside Education from seandelaney.com/podcasts. On the programmes this week and next week, we look at the topic of science teaching, more particularly creative teaching and primary science. To do this, I am joined by Dr. Orla Kelly, who is one of the authors of a new book on the topic titled Creative Teaching in Primary Science. Orla Kelly is a lecturer in social, environmental and scientific education in the Church of Ireland College of Education in Dublin, with responsibility for science, history and geography education. Prior to this appointment in 2013, she was a subject leader for science at Plymouth University, where she worked alongside her co-author on the book, Roger Cutting. Orla is both a chemistry graduate and a qualified speech and drama teacher, and she tries to combine both interests in her work. When I met Orla, I first asked her to outline for me the characteristics of a good scientist.
The first thing for me would be someone who's curious, someone who, wherever they are, whatever they're doing, that they have that curiosity about everything around them. And I suppose we all naturally have things that we're more curious about, but there should be that sense of why things are the way they are, how they work, and a questioning mind, you know, so not just taking things as they are, but being able to like that look at things and ask why. So curiosity and questioning. And I suppose also that ability to be flexible in our understanding, that, you know, if we come across new evidence that kind of sheds new light on something, that we can be flexible in our ideas and change our minds.
And are people born with those traits, or are they traits that can be learned, do you think?
I would say certainly everyone's born with curiosity. We all know children who can just constantly ask all those questions of why, and no matter how many times you give an answer, there's the why. But I think it can get lost. Certainly, you know, sometimes formal schooling with the, you know, the intense curriculum can maybe dampen that a little bit. Certainly that they need to be developed, you know, that they can, like, that sort of flounder if they're not encouraged. And when we look at scientists and the way they investigate the world around them, and like that look, you know, finding new evidence, new ideas, being able to change those ideas and, you know, change their ideas in light of new evidence, you know, that's something that we might need to help people with. You know, that sometimes people can be maybe, this is the way it is, and that's the only way.
So if that's what scientists do, and if that's what scientists need to be, how do you go about teaching science at primary school level?
My whole approach to teaching science is very much around inquiry and problem-based learning. So it's not about teaching facts. It's not about teaching that, you know, plants have so many different parts and this part does this and this part does that. But that we actually would inquire about plants and come up with questions, that the children would come up with questions, and that we would then pursue those. My PhD was in problem-based learning, and that really was what got me passionate about that approach to science, as opposed to one where you're sort of saying, today we are going to look at the parts of a plant.
So it's the children come up with the questions.
Children coming up with the questions.
And yeah. How do you get them to do that? Because obviously they must need some stimulation or some prompting.
Absolutely. So there's a number of factors that would influence that. One would be an environment, the classroom, that would actually stimulate that. So that you'd have lots of displays, you'd bring them in things to look at, to, you know, during their free time. There is things for them to actually look at and to touch and to smell or whatever it might be. So as the teacher, you're encouraging that questioning. But also at the beginning of any lesson, if, say, you want them to come up with questions, you need to give them things to explore. Say, for example, if you wanted them to look at forces and maybe friction and how cars on different surfaces will be faster or slower. Well, rather than starting off and just saying, right, we're going to look into this, you just give them time with the cars and with different surfaces and just let them play for 5 minutes or 10 minutes, whatever it might be. And they will begin to go, oh, when I push it along this surface, it's harder, or when I move along this one, it goes, you know, slower. And the teacher then would just maybe prompt those observations. Oh, what do you notice when you push that car along there? So I think giving them time to explore and giving them lots of things to work with can then begin to generate those observations, which then from there we can generate some questions.
And the form of your PhD was to look at problem-based learning. So does that mean setting problems for children to solve?
Problem-based learning is one of these words that can encompass lots of different types of, I suppose, problem solving. And it really is very similar to inquiry-based learning. So the idea is that you give them a problem. They've got to come up with how they're going to solve it. They've got to come up with the kind of resources they're going to use. They've got to, you know, maybe figure out what the method they're going to use, try that method out. If it doesn't work, go back, try something else. So there's a lot more steps involved than just you're going to do these three steps and solve it. So an example of a problem, say, going back to the idea of the cars on a surface. So you could say, right, we want to build, you know, have a car that's going to go the fastest along the classroom floor, and you just leave that problem with them. So you'd give them some time like that to think, well, what do we need to work at here? Okay, what are the different kind of cars? What are the different surfaces the cars have? You know, the different tires, the size. You know, so they begin to maybe look at the different factors in that. They might look at the surface then of the classroom and think, okay, well, what are the different things that are going to factor in here? And then from there, they would then say, right, well, what we'll do is we'll test these different cars, and they would say what we're going to choose. You might limit them and say, okay, you're going to choose three cars to test, and they would then choose those three cars. Have to think about how often they're going to test them. Obviously, as the teacher there, I would be encouraging them to do some fair testing so that they might repeat it, each car three times. Then they've got to think about how they're going to measure it. Are they going to measure it based on how far they can push the car? Is it going to be that they're going to put it down, you know, some kind of slope and let it run? Or, you know, so they've got to think, is it a time thing, is it a distance? So you're giving them a lot more choice in how they actually do the investigation. I suppose the opposite approach would be, right, you're going to test these cars on this surface. You're going to let them off from here, push them and see how far they go.
And there must be a lot of discussion then as well to compare. Like, say, for example, if my group tests it by putting it down a slope and your group tests it by pushing it along a flat surface, there would be things we could learn from each other.
Absolutely, yeah. So a key part then of that would be discussing and sharing our results at the end and having that kind of reflection and evaluation of, you know, well, what did your group do? Why did it work well? What would you improve if you were going to do it again? And equally then another group might share their results and say, well, this worked for us, or oh, that didn't go so well, and discussing why it didn't go so well. And that's, I think, a really important part for me of the problem-based or an inquiry-based approach, is that it doesn't always work. And I suppose that is a really, you know, a common thing in science, that we think science has one right answer and that there's one way to do things. And maybe that's ingrained in us from maybe the more sort of formal approach, you know, and having maybe done exams in science where you've got to have the right answer. But the reality of science is that there's not one right answer. You know, that there's lots of ways we can get to developing our knowledge, developing our ideas. And actually sometimes something going horrifically wrong is the best way to learn about something and say, well, why did it go wrong? What can we learn from it?
And for a teacher who maybe doesn't know a lot of science themselves or didn't study it to Leaving Cert or to whatever level, wouldn't those kind of lessons, like inquiry-based lessons or problem-based lessons, be challenging? Because they wouldn't necessarily have the scientific knowledge to know whether what's happening is scientifically sound.
Sometimes being of more of a science background can actually restrict you a little bit, because you actually do know the right answer. You know exactly maybe how it should happen. You've got that in your head. Whereas for maybe someone who's not that confident in science, they can maybe be a bit more, well, let's just give it a try and see. And that's how I always approach, you know, my own science when I'm doing science, but particularly with my students. You know, a lot of students, undergraduate students who are training to be primary school teachers, you know, come in with sort of that lack of confidence in science. And I think they're in a way in a good position, because they can empathise with the children and actually learn with them. So I often don't know the answer to things, and I'll sort of say that at the beginning, I don't know, let's find out. So I think there's a certain element of having the confidence to say, we're going to find this out together. If the teacher just keeps the scientific method in the back of their heads, in terms of like that, thinking about fair testing and making sure that the children are making observations, I think that as long as the science method is behind it.
I think that's absolutely critical, because at least if there's a method, then the teacher has something to fall back on. So can you say a little bit about the method that a teacher might use to verify findings, or to even just to guide them in, you know, allowing children to play with inquiry or problem-based lessons?
The first step, as I said earlier, would be giving them a stimulus. So, you know, whether it's a set of toys or cars or plants or, you know, something. And it's about letting the children observe. So observation in science is using our five senses to explore. Now, obviously, tasting in the classroom doesn't happen very often, but it can do. But, you know, whether it's smelling, you know, touching, seeing how they sound, letting children explore and do that, do those observations. And then the teacher would be maybe focusing those observations. So they might make very obvious observations first. So the teacher might then need to say, well, what happens when you rub those two things together? Or what happens when you, you know, tear it? Or what sound does it make? So the first thing would be focusing their observations. And then from there, helping them to turn those observations into kind of questions or investigations. So then once they're doing their investigation, it would be really important to keep in mind the fair testing. And that could be as simple as just maybe repeating the experiment a few times so that they're checking that it hasn't just happened once by chance. Getting them to think about the different variables that they might be using, whether it's time or measuring a distance or the amount of something that they use. And after that, then in some way displaying or communicating their findings. And that can be done in very scientific ways, like a graph or a table, but it could also be done through, you know, a song or a poem or just talking about them. And then that evaluation and reflection then on the results would be key parts. So I think those kind of, you know, the observation, then keeping in mind then, you know, turning those observations into questions and then doing a sort of a fair test investigation with some evaluation then. I think they'd be the kind of, you know, cornerstones of the science method, you know, in primary school.
To what extent does the method vary across physics, chemistry, biology, maybe a little bit of astronomy?
I would say that it doesn't vary. You know, that you can use that same approach really across any of the sciences. Some of them, I suppose, like lend themselves a bit more to practical in terms of, say, you know, physics, like, you know, looking at forces, looking at sound, you know, looking at floating and sinking. You can quite quickly go, oh yeah, I'm going to test those boats, see, or test those things, whether they float or sink. You can maybe see quickly how they
magnetism.
Might be. Magnetism, yeah. Electricity, all of those very practical things. So you can see that how that might lend themselves easily to investigations. But I would say you can still do that with the more natural sciences, with the biology. It's just maybe you might want to take it outside the classroom for that best to happen. So you could bring plants and little mini beasts into the classroom, or you know, you could have interactive displays or things, but you know, actually taking them out might be a good way to do that.
You've given us one example of a lesson that might take place, say, with cars. Can you give us any other examples of what a science lesson might look like in a primary classroom?
Okay. Well, I'm going to maybe give an example of a lesson outside the science classroom, or outside the primary classroom, if that's okay. So, I mean, children absolutely love mini beasts. So worms, spiders, woodlice, snails. Now, the teachers may not like it. And I often have that response from my own class when I'm, you know, doing a kind of that sort of lesson with them. You know, they're like, oh God, we have to touch this, you know. But children, on the other hand, will love nothing more than actually going outside and having a dig around. So an example of a class, you know, you might start the lesson inside and maybe just to have a stimulus of some pictures of some, like that woodlouse or a snail, and just to have they seen these before? Anyone know what they're called? What are they, you know, where have they seen them? And depending on the age group, you might have the focus of, say, habitats. So where might you find them? What are their habitats like? So then you'd sort of say, right, we're going to go outside and we're going to look for them. And you could direct them and say, okay, we're going to go to find a damp corner in the dark. But again, coming back to the inquiry kind of problem-based approach, I'd maybe say, you know, where do you think you might find them? And maybe let them explore outside and get some ideas and then say, okay, yeah, we're going to look under this pile of leaves, or we're going to look in this corner and we're going to have a dig around under this tree. And basically just giving them something as simple as a lunchbox and a little spoon, they can have a little dig around and hopefully they'll find some little creepy crawlies. And what you could then do is take, once they've collected a few, bring them back into the classroom and they can then observe them. They could actually look at, you know, the number of legs they have, or do some observational drawings of them. If the focus was habitats, you could get them to, you could keep them outside and then make some notes on what the habitat's like, you know, and maybe looking at the features of the animal and why they might live there. And then again, come back in and do a bit of discussion then on what people found and sharing results.
Okay. And if you were compiling a list of resources that every teacher should have for a science lesson, what kind of things would you prioritise?
I'm a real believer in not buying purpose kind of made resources. So I tend to get by on quite limited sort of resources. There's certain things like thermometers I think are really handy to have because I find I use those quite a bit. But otherwise, you know, I just use like that lunchboxes, plastic cups, lots of toys, various materials. You know, if I've maybe been doing some DIY at home and I've got some maybe new, old curtains or even just some old building materials, you know, you can use all of those things. I mean, one, you know, in terms of a chemistry type lesson, you could be looking at different materials that are used in the home to build a home. So you could bring in a bit of you know, a brick, you could bring in some, you know, metal or some, you know, and get the children then to explore those. I'd have a very short list of must-haves, but I'd have a long list of things you can pick up along the way.
I remember doing a summer course years ago with John Feehan, the environmentalist, and at the time, now this is going back before internet days even, but he was talking about that any classroom that had a video recorder and did not have a microscope had their priorities all wrong.
Okay.
Would you agree with that?
I would say you could get by without either of them, but certainly I would prefer a microscope to a DVD player. And there are some microscopes that, you know, are kind of suitable for primary classrooms, and certainly they can be very valuable if you know, you can look at materials in much closer detail and look at, you know, obviously leaves and.
So, what kind of a microscope would be particularly useful?
I can't think of the name of this particular one, but it's basically, it's a very child friendly, so it's got nice big, you know, knobs to turn, and the magnification is not a huge amount, but it would allow, say, like that, say a curtain material, you know, that you could actually see the kind of the pattern,
the fibers
yeah, inside, or like that you could look at a leaf and begin to see maybe some of the kind of the pattern inside the leaf. So I think maybe digi blue microscopes.
Okay,
I think they're called. Yeah.
Sometimes when you do an experiment in primary school science, the experiment doesn't work.
Mm.
It might be because of the equipment, or it might be, you know, just the conditions weren't exactly right. How can a teacher respond to that kind of an incident?
Okay, I think that's a really great learning opportunity, and rather than shying away from it, you know, the teacher should embrace that and go, okay, it didn't work, let's look at why it didn't work. So I think getting the children to share what they did, and, you know, it might be that by them actually talking it out, they might realize, oh well, actually, I did one trial and, you know, John did the other one. So, oh, actually, John, did you push it harder than I did? Or did you drop it from higher than I did? Or, you know, so they might discover that actually they did something different each time. Or it could be that maybe they didn't use, you know, they might have measured it wrong. You know, they might have used the ruler. One of them might have used inches, and one might have used centimetres, or, you know, so hopefully by talking it out, they might discover that where they went wrong. But also sometimes things just don't work. You know, you can try things 100 times and sometimes it just won't do the same thing. And I think that's also okay to sort of say, well, that can happen. You know,
yeah,
it's not an exact science, you know. So I think, again, it's a little bit of the teacher having the confidence to take on that discussion. And again, if we just stick to kind of that method, the scientific method, and be thinking, okay, well, what did they do? What were the different factors? What might have influenced the result? You know. And the children will be great at coming up with those ideas themselves, you know, so the teacher just really needs to facilitate that. And other groups, maybe by talking about their results, might prompt another group to go, oh, actually, we forgot to do that, or we did that differently. So I think just the discussion and, that reflection and evaluation will be critical there.
You also have an interest in drama.
Yes.
Can drama be integrated into the teaching of science?
Absolutely. Yeah.
How?
Yeah. Well, actually, that's one of the chapters in the book. I have a personal interest in drama because I studied drama for years, just in my local drama group. And I then kind of continued on studying it and became a qualified drama teacher. And I suppose that was one of the things that I used to really enjoy, was when I'd be teaching drama at the weekends in various kind of stage schools And the parents would say to me, oh, Orla, you know, what do you do during the week? And I said, I'm studying a science degree. And they'd go, what? You know, drama and science. So they just couldn't believe that someone who would be this creative, dramatic person at the weekends would then be a maybe this idea of a boring kind of scientist then during the week. Integrating drama and science allows maybe someone who's not as confident in science, but who maybe has more of the drama skills, you know, to actually really flourish in science, because I think they lend themselves really well. So, I mean, to give you an example of a drama and science lesson, we'll start with kind of a biology example, your living things. So you're looking at maybe food chains. So you might take a popular children's story. So the example that I have from the book is Finding Nemo, which I'm sure most children will be familiar with, the Disney movie. And just taking the selection of marine life that are in that story and then getting the children to freeze frame all those animals under the sea. They might think about the shark being, you know, on top of everybody else, you know, kind of with the predator type look on. You might have the ray kind of right on the bottom, you know, because that's how they kind of camouflage. So the children would begin to think about where the different animal fish might be and how they might be feeling, you know, if they know, actually, I'm at the bottom of the food chain. I know that he wants to eat me, you know. So you could do a freeze frame of that and then get them to actually do a human sort of food chain, you know, so to start, okay, who's at the bottom of the food chain, what do you eat, and work their way up. So you can begin then to introduce some of the science language in terms of predators and prey and primary producers and consumers. So you can use the science language while using some of the drama techniques. And then, I mean, one of the kind of things that children love to do is to quote the line, you know, fish are friends, not foe. And so this is what one of the sharks say this. So what I've done is done a conscience alley where the children have to form two lines. And this is a typical technique used in drama for usually there's a dilemma facing a character, and they have one side of the line sort of gives them maybe one side of an argument and the other side gives them the other side. So for the shark, one side have to say, oh yes, you eat the fish, it's your right to eat the fish, and they've come up with ideas for why they should eat the fish. And then the other side have to say, no, you shouldn't eat the fish, they're your friends, you know. And so again, it's using that drama technique to actually get them thinking about why the sharks actually do have to eat a lot of fish and have to eat the cute little Nemos and things. And again, you're hopefully using some science language.
And can science be integrated with other primary school subjects?
Yeah, I mean, I think science can be integrated with all. If another example from the book would be integration with art and design. So one of the things that you might get children to do, say the lesson that I talked about earlier in terms of having them outside and maybe bringing in some mini beasts that they've collected, you might then get them to do an observational drawing of the mini beast. And so if you've maybe been doing some work with them on art in terms of drawing and lines and textures, you could actually get them to use some of those techniques in doing an observational drawing of the snail they found or the woodlice. And just a little caveat though, in terms of integrating, is that it's really important that the science stays the focus, you know, and it doesn't just become an art lesson or a drama lesson.
And what's the secret to doing that?
I think it's having very, very clear ideas of, you know, I suppose objectives of what you're trying to achieve. And like that, making sure that the science language is all the time coming through, that the science method that I talked about earlier, that's underpinning, you know, what you're doing. So if it's observation that you're trying to develop their skills of observation, when they do the drawing, you want to make sure that they're actually drawing what they see and not just turning it into a comical snail with the little glasses and a little hat or something, which children will do if they're not kept kind of, you know, actually this is an observational drawing of what you're actually seeing. And sometimes children might draw what they remember from another time. I think keeping in mind the science method and using science language when we can, I think, can help to keep the science focus there.
And how has technology impacted on the teaching of science in primary schools?
That's a tricky question. I'm not a huge advocate of technology. It's not that I'm not an advocate of it, but I think you can do a lot without it. But when you use it, it can be very effective. You mentioned the microscopes earlier, and I've certainly seen, you know, microscopes being used, little digital microscopes being used quite nicely in the classroom. So like that, you can actually link up what you're seeing in the microscope onto the interactive whiteboard. And so everyone can, you know, share what they see, I suppose, because before you would just see where the one child would see it, and then someone else would come along and perhaps see something different. Or so being able to share, you know, through the whiteboard, something that's on the microscope is really nice. Yeah, it's funny because that was probably the chapter when we were writing our book, the technology one, we both felt a little bit sort of hesitant about putting in. But yeah, because I think we both feel that we can do a lot without it.
Okay. And if we go on, because the reason we're talking is because of your book, which you co-wrote with Roger Cutting, and it's called Creative Teaching in Primary Science. Mm-hmm. How did that book come about?
Roger and I were both fairly new lecturers at the University of Plymouth, where I worked for nearly 7 years. And he had started, I think, at the Easter, and I started then in August of the same year. And we were team teaching on a module together. And after the sort of halfway through that first year, we both felt, I suppose, a certain dissatisfaction with the module. And we kind of thought, oh, you know, it'd be nice to do something different. So we actually applied for a teaching fellowship award within the university, and we got it. So the project that we got the money to do was to develop a problem-based module, basically for our students.
And these are for student teachers?
For student teachers, yeah. So it was on a Bachelor of Education program there. And so we sort of begun to look at developing problems around, you know, physics, chemistry and biology, and then sort of some general problems once they'd, you know, explored a little bit content and relevant skills. And then sort of after a year of doing that, while we were happy that we developed these problems and the students had responded to them, we still felt a certain dissatisfaction. So we were kind of constantly changing and coming up with new ideas. And I suppose the book, in a way, captures a lot of that, you know, the different things we tried. And from that, I mean, I probably, you know, introduced Roger to the problem-based learning side of things, but he also showed me, you know, he's been teaching for a lot longer than I have, and so has, I suppose, other skills and other repertoire of teaching approaches that maybe I hadn't encountered before. So I suppose we both made positive changes to how we taught, and we've shared a lot of that in the book.
And the book referred to by Orla Kelly is Creative Teaching in Primary Science by Orla Kelly and Roger Cutting. On next week's programme, I'll continue my discussion with Orla. Remember, you can listen to or download podcasts of this and all previous Inside Education programmes on insideed.com. You can get in touch with me by emailing feedback or suggestions to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.